This is Innovating Leadership, Co-Creating Our Future. I'm your host, Maureen Metcalf, the founder and CEO of the Innovative Leadership Institute, where we help leaders be future ready. Helping us on that mission today is returning guest Neil Sahota. Neil is an IBM Master Inventor, United Nations AI Advisor, and professor at UC Irvine. This multi-part series will take you through the five reasons organizations fail at AI and recommendations to ensure you're not one of those failures. So Neil, welcome.
Hey Maureen, great to be back.
Great to have you back. And this idea of reasons for failure is kind of intriguing. You've identified five fatal mistakes enterprises make when implementing AI. Can you briefly outline those mistakes and explain why four of them are people-centric?
Yeah, sure. It's an interesting thing in that I see a lot of companies today that are like, hey, we try to do something with AI, doing the common use cases in our industry, and we failed spectacularly. Yet our competitors who are not as smart as us got it done. And so they're really wondering, why is that happening? And it's more a people challenge and requires more leadership. And so let me share the five. And as the listeners are tuning in, see which one you can guess is not a people one. But the number one most common failure point is they treat AI as software. And it's not really software. It's a high energy intern. So number two, they're just looking at tools. Every day, there's about 12 new AI tools that get released. Some are hype, some are legit, but they're trying to figure out what are the right tool or a couple of tools to try and use. Again, it doesn't quite work that way. Number three is more around actually expectations, what people believe AI can or cannot do. Number four, relying on the smart technologist to tell you the pain points of the business and tell you where to use AI. And number five, and this is the one I think a lot of people will be surprised by, is only looking at automation rather than also thinking about innovation. So rather than just taking what you already have and automating everything, including the flaws, looking for a better way of doing the work.
And the last one has been an issue for decades. There was an article when I first started working about don't pave the cow paths.
For sure, Maureen, right? For better or worse, we tend to wire organizations to look for continuous improvement. And I'm not saying there's anything wrong with that, but you cannot continually improve a candle and somehow achieve the light bulb. So if we have new tools, new capabilities, all these things, we should be looking for better ways of just doing our work.
I do see how that's a people issue. Getting humans to reconceptualize what we do and how we do it can be tough.
We're basically taking the approach that we're trying to fix something that's not necessarily broken, right? And for a lot of people, it's like, why would you waste resources and time trying to do that? You could actually create a lot more value that way. We don't use leeches to treat ourselves for health issues anymore, right?
My doctor does not. I'm not sure about others. How are those people problems? Because some of them sounded technology-centric.
Let's start with the most common one first then. Let's talk about the perception that AI is software, and it's really not. It's a high energy intern. And again, we're used to computers running a program. Program is just a set of instructions, so you have a hard-coded path, exception paths, all these things. You don't really program AI. You teach it. You give it what we call ground truth, rules on how to make decisions. You give it data, you give it human teachers, and that's how it learns and becomes competent. But the problem is everyone wants to buy a box, right? If I need help doing my taxes, I'm going to buy a software package that's good at tax preparation. If I need something that's going to help me manage paid time off and associated employee benefits, there's software packages to do that. And so everyone's looking like, where's the AI software package that's going to do X for me? That's actually not how AI works. It's not software. You don't program it, again, like you teach it. So if you want to get the most out of AI, you have to think of it as a high energy intern. AI is ready to do whatever tasks you give it, no matter how boring, tedious, administrative, grunt work, and do it without complaint and do it 24/7. But like any human intern, you have to teach it how to do it first. So you got to teach it your business on your data, your processes, all these things, because we all operate a little differently. So you're not really running a program for the AI. You're telling it how to do something for your company.
I'm curious. I did a presentation last night on AI and leadership. So the book we wrote, and one of the questions was, intern means they don't yet know everything. They still need to learn. How do you make sure they get it right?
That's why I use the word intern. It's not going to be perfect. But for the AI and these hallucinations, what we have to understand is that it doesn't know what it doesn't know. And we create something, it doesn't actually understand the content and the context of it. And so there are things that we actually take for granted. We've probably all heard the story. It still happens today, surprisingly. You get a lawyer, goes to like ChatGPT and says, give me 3 cases that support my case strategy that I can use in court. And you get these things and they don't check them. Well, the thing with AI is it doesn't understand intuitively that when you ask for a supporting case and use it as a precedent, it has to be true, right? It doesn't actually know that. So when you ask it with a prompt saying, give me 3 cases that support my case strategy, it's going to create 3 perfect cases as precedent. Anything AI does should be considered a draft, right? Much we review an intern's work, the same thing we should be doing with AI.
One of the things that strikes me is we think we're training it. It is also training us to be more precise in our inquiry. So give me 3 accurate, well-tested cases. And then it's a management issue. It's a leadership issue. I wouldn't have my junior associate or my intern go prepare my legal case and not review it and stand up in court. That just seems like bad practice.
And I think that's part of the challenge, that we still think of AI as a computer, as software. So it's like, if it gives me an output, it must be accurate, right? It must be true because it's following some path. It's doing a calculation. And it's like, again, it's not software. It's an intern. Interns are going to make mistakes. AI is not perfect. Our data is flawed and it has human teachers and we're not perfect. The goal is that the person using the machine is more accurate than just the person or just the machine.
So it is the human machine hybrid.
Yeah, we call that hybrid intelligence. We talk about what's the future of work, where are we going in terms of like leadership and management, it's towards hybrid intelligence. Look, we know that AI is going to be better at us looking at millions of variables and scenarios and math and all these things, but there's a lot of things that people are much better than AI. First-of-a-kind situations, creative thinking. And we've seen this. It's the person using AI is far more effective. That's why when people ask me, is AI going to take my job? I'm like, no, but the person using AI will take your job, right? I like it to this, and I find, unfortunately, it's becoming a dying example, but chess. If you're a human being, you play against an AI chess player, your odds of winning are 1 out of 1,000,000. However, a human teamed up with an AI chess player, just playing against an AI chess player, wins 9 out of 10 times.
Interesting. We will see the AIs continue to learn. So at some point, they may be smarter than us, either at specific tasks or agents at bigger tasks.
Well, there's some things AI is better than us that we find surprising. I mean, that's failure point number 3 there. We'll get to that. But the honest truth is, the AI won't be able to do things unless we're able to teach it. And like one of the things we have not been able to figure out is how to teach creative thinking. The AI is never going to be good at creative thinking because we don't know how to actually teach that. Ourselves, sometimes we're not really the best creative thinkers either. So if we can't teach ourselves, how are we going to teach the machine?
I wonder if at some point the machine figures out how to teach the machine, but that's a maybe different topic.
You're getting the whole thing about now AI interacting with AI in the near future. I mean, you're going to have an AI assistant and some AI sales bot's going to try and convince your AI assistant to buy something.
So what you're telling me is my password vault should be my head, not some separate AI system?
Might be a good idea.
Okay, so what was number 2?
Number 2 is this whole idea of tools. We hear about all these companies, they're all doing AI. Some of it, like I said, is hype. Some of it is not really AI. Some of it doesn't really quite work the way it's promised. And some of it is legitimate. And on average, there's about 12 new tools that come out every day. How to even parse through this. I'm a big believer of not reinventing the wheel, but it's not a question of just mix and matching tools together to get you what you need, right? Again, because you have to teach the AI, there's some level of customization. Back in the day, we're doing some work with H&R Block. They were looking at things like, could AI help us, you know, with tax preparation? Kind of looking at the data, about 70% of tax returns are fairly the same. So it's a good use case for AI. You can teach it about the tax code, have it read all these things, right? But it's not like, okay, I just pluck this tool over here and I pluck this tool over here and I have what I need. We use several different APIs and tools, but you still have to spend time teaching it. What do some of these concepts mean? Give it the various tax codes, doing that instruction, teaching it the way H&R Block prepares taxes, how they communicate with the clients. So all those things had to be factored in. They built it and it works for the most part pretty well. When the AI prepares the tax return, I mean, it will ask for stuff that might be missing. It'll prepare it, but then a human accountant actually reviews the work, make sure everything looks okay. And because that human review, you know, we actually noticed something early on that made our heads spin a bit, and that the AI tax returns, the tax refund was about $236 higher. And it was like, why is that happening? Is it making a mistake somewhere? So we're looking through it. And we notice it's going like, well, this person qualifies for this $25 tax credit over here because the, you know, the municipality has this $50 tax rebate. They're all legitimate deductions, right? It's just, they're so kind of minute and stuff. The typical human account didn't realize that. You know, have you ever tried to read the tax code? You know, you got federal, state, municipal. You know, if you have insomnia, I recommend it. But because it remembers every line of that tax code, every time it changes, it knows what people are actually eligible for. So we can actually catch and aggregate a lot of these small things, which is why those people were getting a slightly higher tax refund.
So to your point, there are things it already does better.
Yeah, I mean, it's catching that level of details. Eidetic memory, it's going to remember everything in the tax code, the tax laws. There's no human that can do that.
One of the things I take away from this then is 12 new programs a day or a minute. Having someone who is an expert in AI and probably the industry and what's coming out related to my industry would be very helpful rather than me trying to keep up on it.
I would say there's two things you can do, especially as a non-technical person. If you're looking at a vendor or a tool, number one, is there anybody on their team that has domain experience? Mm. Someone's trying to sell you an AI marketing tool. Does anybody on their core team there actually do marketing? Is that actually their background? Because if it's not, how do they know? I'll give you an example of this. Ironically, Meta has been burned by this twice. First with Instagram, then with Facebook. They rolled out their new AI ad tools, and there were, you know, you had some real estate agents trying to market properties, and the AI intentionally excluded certain groups. Thinking like, well, either they couldn't afford it or whatever, something in there triggered AI to do that. And so they got busted for redlining. There's Fair Housing Act. You cannot exclude people, any group of people from residential housing advertising. And so second time they get busted, they're like, oh my God, another huge fine. So they go to their engineers and like, how come you guys didn't account for redlining? And the engineers are like, what's redlining? You know, they're smart technologists, but they don't understand the regulatory environment of the housing market. They don't know what their Fair Housing Act is. So it never entered into their mind to incorporate that as part of the teaching.
They incorporated things they understood, like the software would weed out bullies, but not...
Yeah, that's the problem. The number one thing I tell people is check they actually have the right domain expertise in the team. If they don't, there's no way they could have built an effective tool. The second thing I always say is, what was their training strategy? They should be able to share a few things on how they train the AI and general information about the training sets for the AI system, because you teach it with biased data, with flawed ground truth, the AI is going to make mistakes.
It may take a while for those mistakes to surface, and at that point, you've done harm.
And a great example of this, I'll go back in time a bit, but Amazon. Most people probably heard the story, but Amazon built an AI recruiting tool. I think they launched it in 2017, 2018, and it turned out that it was sexist. They took 10 years of hiring history and resumes, people they hired, didn't hire, success, right? But the thing they didn't really account for, and you know, and again, it's maybe a little unconscious thing, but this is again where leadership becomes very important, is if you look at Amazon's hiring history, they predominantly hired men for a variety of reasons we don't need to get into here. But the AI basically learned that what's the difference between some of these candidates. And it's not that, you know, there's the genders on those resumes, but what it learned was that when men speak and write, they use certain types of words and women use different kinds of words. And so there's a difference in the language that I don't think people picked up on, at least consciously, but the AI did. That's how it was able to filter the resumes. As a result, if you're using words that women tended to use on resumes, it would deprioritize.
Interesting.
And thus created a sexist bias.
So I should use an AI to edit all of my writing?
Well, we're getting to the point now where I think everyone's generating their stuff with AI, so it's kind of hard to tell now, right?
So it was only a short-term bias.
I don't know about that, right? Because you're seeing more and more tools out there trying to screen out generated resumes and things that maybe there's a different kind of bias going on now.
So what's number four?
Well, the tools was number two.
Okay.
So number three is actually around what we think AI can or cannot do. We've come in with this attitude that, you know, we're used to getting to the second generation of computers, do something faster, cheaper, less errors, software programs. There's some things computers can't do, like AI cannot understand emotions, right? And we've actually shown and benchmarked that AI actually can understand emotions. It doesn't feel them, but we've been able to teach them what these emotions mean for people and the science. And what we've actually found is that AI is far better at detecting the emotional state of a person than another human being is. The AI has a laser-like focus on you. It's not thinking about what to say back. It's not wondering what the kids are up to or what was that sound over there, right? And while the best human can look at maybe 5 to 7 points in terms of body language in real time, AI is looking at hundreds of thousands of points. It's looking at your word choice, the inflection of your voice. It's processing a lot more data to figure out your emotional state. So as you start switching, maybe you start becoming angry, it's already picked up on that and changing how it interacts with you.
I attended the International Leadership Association conference last year, and I walked in with the bias that computers can't manage humans. And what it said is for basic interactions, that it is actually better at interacting with humans, and it doesn't forget. If you tell it to go say hello in the morning, it says hello to everybody. It's not tired. It hasn't missed its first cup of coffee. It can read you consistently and shows up.
Yeah. I mean, that's the beauty of AI. It's not going to get tired. But again, you have to teach it to do these things. The funny thing, though, is that if you've taught it some of these things we call like psychographics and neurolinguistics, it'll learn the specific patterns of people. So learn like this. When I greet this person in the morning, they like a high energetic high. Or this person likes, you know, when you crack a joke as part of the good morning. And so it'll actually custom to create a deeper level of engagement with each of those people.
Depending on the sensitivity of the human manager, that isn't necessarily a given.
Yeah. I have tough days or we're in a hurry. Get that, right? The flip side here is also more fascinating in that people, I always say, like, well, aren't people kind of a little coy or they're a little skeptical or, you know, maybe they're uncomfortable talking with an AI? And what we've actually found is no, that people are actually far more comfortable talking to the AI than their human being. They'll actually tell the AI things they would not tell like their boss, their doctor, their lawyer, because they feel like they're not being judged.
There's an HBR article, How People Are Really Using Gen AI in 2025. And one of the top uses is therapy and companionship.
Ironically, probably more empathetic from the AI boss. Yeah. I hate to say it that way. The Los Angeles PD is trying to use AI chatbots to do minor police reports, like your bicycle stolen. They're doing this because it frees up officer time for more serious offenses. But what they've also found is that when people are filing a police report, they're a little more honest with the information that they're sharing. I think there was a case where some guy's car was stolen out of their driveway or something like that. And you know, they're saying like this, and the AI is just like, well, this car door is locked. And the guy's like, I think I forgot to lock the car doors. Whereas if it was a human officer, they would probably never attest. Like, oh, yeah, of course I locked my car door. You know? I would never do such a stupid thing, you know?
Really interesting use cases then.
The companionship is an interesting one. because there's a lot of work that's been done in that space. I mean, before COVID, loneliness was the biggest illness in the world. I think about 40% of people suffered from moderate to severe loneliness. The question became is, you know, someone that is that lonely, how do you create a safe space for them where they can at least feel connected? So not substitute out human relationships, but create an environment where they at least feel connected, that they feel like they can take some of those next steps to address the loneliness and maybe build those human relationships. We found that AI was a good fit. These empathetic AI bots are now robots that are out there. It was a lot easier for these people to establish that kind of communication, feel some level of connection to something. Because again, they didn't feel like the AI is judging them or taking pity on them or any of those things. It's just like, it's literally just listening to me. You know, it's acknowledging the things that I say.
Which is something that most of us want, whether or not we're lonely, we appreciate the empathy and the understanding.
In the workplace, sometimes people just want to be heard, right? It's not necessarily that they want to push their own idea or some of these things, but they want to feel like that I'm being acknowledged and I feel like I'm actually contributing in some capacity. What is it, brainstorming? It's 90% of the time, it's either the first or second idea that gets picked as people anchor to that. So you think about that, we don't really create that level of environment where people really feel like they're probably being heard.
I'm thinking often we would like that at home too. Come home and have someone ask how your day was and sit and listen intently rather than thinking about making dinner, running out the door to get the kids, all the stuff that we do as we're saying, hi, honey, welcome home, let's go.
That's why we talk about AI companion. It's always there, right? If you ever watch the show Black Mirror, I think that episode White Christmas with John Hamm, they literally take your brain engrams and imprint that to create your AI assistant. So the AI knows you as well as you know yourself. Right, so it can actually anticipate your needs and all these things. And so that's why it became the ultimate companion for you. It's pay what you probably want for breakfast. You had a bad day at work and, you know, play your favorite song. You know, that's kind of the holy grail for a lot of people. But that means then you talk about empathetic AI. There you go. That's what a lot of people really want.
What's the next of the five failures?
Number four is trying to rely on the smart technologists to tell us what to do with AI. I'm probably going to freak some people out with this for a variety of reasons, but I'll ask you the question, Maureen. Would you let Elon Musk perform open heart surgery on you?
Not with his chainsaw.
How about Mark Zuckerberg? Would you let him manage your retirement portfolio?
I'm sure Mark is brilliant at a lot of things, but not everything.
That's what you typically hear from people. It's like, no, and why not? Is Musk doesn't know how to do open heart surgery. Zuckerberg doesn't know how to manage retirement portfolio. That's not their strengths, right? They haven't been trained in those things. Then why are you relying on your smart technologists to solve the problems of your doctors, your lawyers, your marketers, your financial analysts, your customer service reps? They don't know that space. The technologists are good at creating the tools, right? They're going to keep building better hammers and saws for you. But the use, right, how you actually use these tools comes from domain experts.
This ties back to your earlier comment about redlining and Amazon.
That's the key thing that we tend to forget. We think it's a IT thing, so technologists will be able to tell us what to do. But it's like we're hiring an intern or hiring a high-energy intern. We're not buying a software package.
This ties to our joint book talking about the 10 things leaders need to do. One is have domain expertise.
100%. You can't lead something you don't really fully understand.
Yeah, the lawyer who asked the AI to go come up with three precedent-winning cases needed to have legal experience. You wouldn't want me doing that.
No offense to you, Maureen, but yeah, you want the right knowledge in play here, right? Because you're teaching the AI. And that's what we tend to forget. A lot of people treat AI as like an IT project. The technologists just don't know the on-the-ground problems of a lawyer or a marketer or these folks, or the regulatory environment, or the challenges working with users or patients or clients. That's why you look at like legal tech. There was a ton of money pumped into AI and legal, and 90% of it got wiped out because they were investing in technologists, not lawyers or paralegals. You look at the ones that were successful, a company called Legalmation. It was started by three lawyers, no technical knowledge, but they understood the space, right? They're like, you know, one of the tedious things to do is read a complaint and generate the corresponding court documents. It takes a few hours of an associate lawyer's time. Could AI do something like that, right? And so they looked at the problem. They learned a little bit about how to use the tools. They said, this looks like it's feasible. Then partner up with smart technologist people to actually help build and train the AI system. Very successful with it today, right? And I know a lot of people ask, what about those associate lawyers that used to do that work? They didn't get fired. They're actually doing more important work now. Now they can actually do things like jury selection. They can do rainmaking like business development. So they're doing things that add more value to the firm. But they only got to this point because, hey, we as lawyers understand the challenges here and the monotony of this type of work.
Having been involved in ERP implementation, so enterprise software, typically enterprise-wide program, so we have the technologists, but we also had subject matter experts in every area. I need to understand order to cash, which means I need financial people engaged so that the machine diverts the money to the right place. So it sounds like the same principles or similar to implementing effective solutions, not software, would come into play.
100%, Maureen, that's the thing. Look, there's a lot of smart technologists out there, and some are probably in each of our organizations, but that doesn't mean they have the right answers for us. Well, one of the reasons I wanted to start the whole AI for Good initiative in the United Nations was, look, if you just leave it up to technologists and you only put a bunch of smart technologists in the room, they're going to think of things like a flying car. They're not going to think about like, well, could we leverage some of these things to build solutions to help fight climate change or advance medicine? That's why we really need a community. That's why the best AI solutions come from domain experts, not technologists. Let the technologists build the better hammer for you, but you as a domain expert, a subject matter expert, have to learn how to use the hammer. The technologists don't think of those things. All they know is they built to an outcome. I need a better hammer. It has to be lighter, right? Whatever, they're going to do that. They're not thinking about like how people will use the hammer, which is a whole different set of issues because they're not thinking about other uses, misuses. But again, that's on us as domain experts to also anticipate how these tools might be used.
And the risks associated with each use or misuse.
I always say, look, I could build a house with a hammer or I could tear one down.
So then what's the last one?
The last one is that we're stuck on automation over innovation. So when people or organizations think about where to use AI, all they're thinking about is doing something faster, cheaper, less errors. And I'm not saying there's anything wrong with that. You're only tapping into a handful of capabilities. So you're only unlocking 20, 30% of the value. And because we're so focused on continuous improvement, it's a leadership challenge. When we automate something, we're also automating all the drawbacks, all the flaws, all these things that exist with our current way of doing the work. So we're not taking a look at the opportunities like, well, I got some new tools. I still have my hammer and saw, but I got this widget thing over here. What could that do for me? We don't look at, is there a better way of actually doing the work now? That's where innovation really comes in. What's that better way of changing the process or the system to unlock more value? For better or worse, as many companies say that we want entrepreneurial thinking, often either seem risk averse, want to make the investment, or the most common thing I hear is like you're trying to fix something that's not really broken.
The examples of this would then be Uber, Airbnb, Netflix, external companies who've fix the not broken thing until there's a fix that renders the other solutions broken.
Think about disruption, right? We throw that word around a lot. People tend to forget because it's probably normalized now that Walmart disrupted healthcare. So how does a big box retailer do that? They just learned that, look, we have the physical locations, you know, where we tend to build in low density areas or rural areas. We can bring some of these tools, AI or not, but, you know, we can provide services like eye exams and basic physicals, some of these other things. And why do they do that? It's like, well, while you're here waiting for your classes or something, you can buy other stuff. That's the motivation. But some of these things couldn't be replicated. I mean, Amazon, I think, had the idea first, but you can't really take an eye exam using telehealth. And so that's the thing. I mean, I remember back in the day, Airbnb, their original model was you get a beanbag and your host makes you breakfast in the morning. And they just wanted to build it up enough to show that enough people would use it to sell it to Marriott. And they actually got a chance to pitch Marriott after they had some traction. And Marriott said, you can't be a hotel chain without owning real estate, right? It's not possible. Well, guess who's the biggest hotel chain in the world today? Airbnb. And they don't own any real estate. A different way of doing the work.
That illustrates then beautifully that for those of us who are not rethinking the work and disrupting, we are likely to be disrupted at some point.
Yeah, and you might get disrupted by either one of those startup companies, or you more likely get disrupted by somebody in a different industry. Right now, like one of the things that I'm seeing is the marketers were one of the first to really embrace AI. For a marketer, the best way to try and sell somebody your product is to know them like a best friend. It was never really feasible. I can't know thousands, let alone millions of people like a best friend. But guess what? AI has enabled that. Thanks to psychology and neurolinguistics, behavioral science, all these things. Just with 100 words, AI can know you as well as a best friend. It understands your hobbies, your opinions, your interests, even your political party, right? And just scrape that information off social media, your LinkedIn profile, wherever it's publicly available. And so the marketers can actually know you as a best friend. The interesting thing is you look at some industries like the movie industry, the film industry, they still market $50 million for one of these movies, marketing budget, a couple of big things, and all they're doing is kind of like a one-size-fits-all. They don't want to believe that they could target all these people like a best friend. You know, and to put this in perspective, you look at the movie, I think Top Gun Maverick, it did about $600 million domestic box office. If you strip out people who went and saw the movie multiple times, it worked out to, I think they had 31 or 32 million unique people in the United States see the movie. But when you ask the question, how many people you think would have watched the movie, you start hearing numbers like it's probably about 85 or 90 million. So it's like you captured a little over a third. You could have actually done so much better, but you know, people fixate on the 600 million and they don't really dig into the numbers. It's like you probably left another $600 million on the table. Think about that. Completely different perspective. So it's like there's a better way of doing marketing that they're now kind of scratching their heads and going like, how does that work?
This is enabled in relatively small companies. Again, talked to a CEO group last night. One of the women said when she gets incoming inquiries, they do that scraping and they send back a customized response. That organization is not as big as the Top Gun folks.
And that's what I found. The small to medium-sized businesses are more open to the innovation conversation. It's not just a matter of survival, but also thriving these days because they're facing a lot of different pressures. So while the big companies automate and kind of eat into some of their traditional business, they need to find different channels to be more effective. The billable hour is getting killed off in the legal industry. And now even the big law firms are realizing that I have to bid on work. I have to bid fixed price. How do I even do some of these things? They're looking at AI tools for cost efficiencies now, so they can provide a more market competitive price because no one's paying the billable hour.
We did a project to create a vision playbook for a client. The client had two bids. I was already working with them and we were able to produce it for about a third of the price using AI. So we still spent all of the time socializing the results, revising the thing. But the amount of time and the amount of cost they saved, well over half. Yes, my billable hours were fewer, and that allowed the client to get more value on that project and hopefully spend the rest of those billable hours on something else that was also value add.
And that's what we really want, right? We want to give people more value add work, more complex, meaningful work. Again, it's a leadership thing in that we don't tend to frame it that way. We're going to introduce some of these tools. We're going to automate some of these things. You don't tell the value proposition to your employees. And so you built in natural resistance to any kind of change.
What specific leadership qualities are essential to navigate the challenges of integrating AI successfully?
Well, other than reading the book we put together that outlines all those items, for a leader, I think one critical step beyond reading the book is to understand that successful implementation of AI actually requires hands-on leadership. You can't treat it like an IT project. You can't treat it like this is a box or something we've done hundreds of times. This is very much a people change. You know, 4 of the 5 points of failure are related to people. And so it's our job as good leaders, innovative leaders, to drive that change, to champion it, show the value propositions, you know, to address those people concerns and lead the charge. Otherwise, the honest truth is you're going to be like those other companies that keep on, all we did was fail. We failed again. Yet again, our competitors who are not as smart as we are did it with ease. Those companies, they tackle the leadership challenge when it comes to AI.
Tackling the leadership challenge at the outset, not after we define the solutions, all that stuff, but leaders charter the project, sponsor the project, actively engage in the project all the way along. They're implementing a business solution, not a software program.
Yeah, think of it as, again, AI is a high energy intern. You're hiring an army of interns. What are you going to do with them? Just imagine that they were human. How would you handle that similar approach with AI, right? You're not just going to hand them, here's some requirements, right? Go build me some interns. It doesn't work that way.
Neil, thank you so much for recording episode 1, talking about the 5 failure points of implementing AI. In the next segment, we're going to get into more organizational context. So culture, organizational dynamics, ethics, communication, change management, so that our listeners have a more robust perspective on implementation. How do listeners learn more about you, about AI for good and what you're doing at the UN, and follow your really brilliant work?
You can come to my website, just my name, neilsahota.com. I'm always sharing out some of the latest information and trends in the industry. If you're looking for a lot more tactical help for your organization, please visit my Substack, which is just my name, neilsahota@substack.com. Or you can also follow me on social media. My work with the United Nations, we have a portal, just Google United Nations AI for Good, and you'll find it quite easily. If you want to know the latest, greatest, and you want some things, best practices, I encourage you to check out both my website and my Substack.
Thank you. And until next week. To our listeners, thank you for joining us today on Innovative Leadership, Co-Creating Our Future. Are you interested in elevating the quality of your leadership? The Innovative Leadership Institute offers best-in-class leadership development, executive advising, and organizational transformation services. Send me a note at inquiries@innovativeleadership.com. The world's most successful leaders are created here.
Do you love amazing stories? I know I do. I'm Michael Kent, and every week on my show, we examine something from history that's so unbelievable it sounds made up, but is 100% verifiably true. It's a podcast called The Internet Says It's True, and there are hundreds of episodes to choose from. For example, did you know the story of how Leonard Nimoy came up with Live Long and Prosper for Star Trek? Or how Columbia is dealing with a hippo problem that goes back directly to Pablo Escobar? Or one of my favorite stories, a man figured out that a nondescript Winnebago being auctioned online was actually an important part of space exploration history. These are all stories from The Internet Says It's True. Listening to a podcast has never been easier. You can listen through any popular podcast app, through the NPR app, or download the fantastic new WCBE app, click the Podcasts tab, and look for The Internet Says It's True with Michael Kent. You'll have so many stories up your sleeve, you'll feel like the smartest person in the room, especially if you're home alone.
Hi, this is Sue Foley, inviting you to listen to Music Journeys. Hear local and national artists share how the love of music began and what inspired their latest project. Mike Foley blends it all together with some music. Now, you can't believe him if he says he's related to me and inherited my musical talent, but you can be sure that other Foley will deliver a worthwhile listening experience too.
I guess I'm all right being that other Foley. Listen to Music Journeys Saturday afternoons at 3:30.
And in the podcast experience at wcbe.org.